there we go.
So, Julian, I suppose one of the first questions for me is that you was at Grace, managing at Grace.
Yes.
And how did that whole experience go for yourself?
I really enjoyed it. I got on well with my chairman. There's obviously a lot of people telling me not to get involved at Grays for obvious reasons. But like with Mickey Woodward and Andy Swallow, I got on absolutely superb with them. And like I said, I really enjoyed my time there. But at the end of the season, to be honest, it was time to go separate ways.
So I mean, what would you say was the best sort of time you had at Grays? I mean, was there a time at Grays that was, you know, the whole time? Cause, I mean, I've read little bits and bobs about having to be, you got sort of relegated and stuff like this as well. So it was a real sort of tough time at that time as well.
It was. I mean, we were in the conference, and the players weren't good enough to play in the conference, and we struggled. But until like I've got a lot of my players in that I wanted, maybe the last 10 games of the season, we started to do well. Obviously, beat Boris Green and. And drew with York and teams like that. So it was at the end of it in the conference was a lot better. Once you go in there, you have to sort your players out. You don't know, so you've got to get the right players for the right time.
So I mean, you was at we've Canvey. I mean, did you? You was at Canvey as well. Playing for Canvey.
Played for Canvey. Yeah. One because I knew Jeff King. From long ago, my agent Rachel knew Jeff King as well, and I obviously retired at West Ham when I was 29, and I had a couple of years out, and I thought like my knee would be able to stand that kind of pressure, non-league football, and I only played 12 games, and again my knee gave way, but again I really enjoyed it at Canvey with Glenn Pennyfather and Jeff and the lads. We had such a good team. We had a good cup run. Like I said, we beat Wigan. At Wigan, beat Northampton at Canvey, and then they got beat at Burnley. So, but it was a good time. Really enjoyed it.
So that sort of time as well, wasn't it? They were like really going up in the top of the conference as well, wasn't it?
No, we weren't in the conference then, but we were at the top of the league. But the thing is, like you're playing Northampton, you're getting like 3,000 people behind the ramp. The next game's a normal game. You're getting like 500. And obviously Jeff was just keep chucking money into the club, and he got no return for it, really.
Well, we always talk about it on the show around the fact that you look at it, and I'm surprised the amount of people that don't turn up for their local clubs. I mean, I know it's difficult when you've got the likes of, say, here at Harlow, or you've got Waltham Abbey or Maidstone. I mean, Maidstone's probably a little bit different because they're getting sort of like 1,200 people every home game, but some of the grounds, even when you get to like non-league day as well, you don't seem to get that many people sort of pick it up and think, well look, let's go down and watch a really good game of football down at my local club.
Yeah, but the problem is it's still not cheap. Even non-league football is not cheap. Like some grounds like 15, 20 quid to get in. I mean, that's expensive to watch non-league football. I think personally it's expensive to watch non-league football. So if you're taking your family of four, you're still looking at like 60, 70 quid. I mean, that's ridiculous to watch football.
Yeah. So, I mean, the other thing I suppose as well with non-league football, I know quite a lot of the clubs now are going to sort of like the 4G surface, the 3G surface. Do you think that's possibly a way to go for the non-league clubs and moving forward?
Well, one, you have to pay for it. And it obviously costs a lot of money. I know, obviously, in the long run, it will pay for itself. But the initial outlay, obviously, is very expensive. And again, not a lot of non-league clubs can't afford that. So, I mean, looking at the pitch here, I mean, it's fantastic. Again, obviously, you get the kids can train on it and make revenue that way. So, me personally, I don't like AstroTurf. I don't like playing on AstroTurf. So, that's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, I must admit, we get a lot of people. We had a club come down not so long ago, and they were not too impressed about having to play on it. But I think once they played on it and they actually beat us, I think they were perfectly all right, really.
Yeah, it's right. The thing is, it's all right if you win. I remember playing Oldham, and we're getting beat 6-0 on their AstroTurf. I mean, but that was like concrete. Even like the 4G stuff, I mean, for me, I wouldn't like to play on it.
Not good for the knees?
Well, I mean, it's better... like nowadays, and it used to be, but I just like grass pitches and Sorry, it's a training pitch, that's fine.
So, I mean, something else I was going to ask you as well, because I was coming up on the car and I thought to myself, I saw that this morning and I don't know if you've seen it yourself. Did you see, and offers sort of like non league football as such, but did you see the Revel Morrison goal that he scored yesterday in under 21? So, it'd be worth a watch because it was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen in training, where guys crossed it in from the, I think from the left hand side, and as he's running towards the box, he sort of jumped up in the air but volleyed it, but Spanny's, he's sort of like his right foot inside his left foot and smashed it into the top corner from outside the box. And it's all over YouTube, it's all over Sky Sports News this morning about how he smashed his goal into the top corner and of this goal. But he's a cracking goal. One of the questions was asked was, someone sent into us was, who, I suppose the best thing to ask you is what you've said before about non-league football, about not seeing too much of it lately, but who would you have said was, if there were any players out there that you've seen in non-league when you was in non-league that really impressed you?
Yeah, I mean, when you're playing against these teams, you look at them, and some players do stand out. But, I mean, when I was at Grays, we had some good players. I mean, really good players. But again, some of them, it was their attitude. But obviously, when you're playing against other teams, yeah, there's one or two players that do stand out. And for me personally, I think there's quite a few players in non-league, for me personally, could play pro football. But again, you have to have the right attitude. I mean, there's some good players out there with a stinking attitude. So, I mean, they're never going to make it.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that. Well, I heard it on one of the other radio programs, and they were talking on there on their sports bar, and they were talking on there around about that. Zach said something you were saying, and I think somebody was on there, and they were talking about non-league football, and he was saying like the amount of players there are in the conference. That what are they doing in the conference when they should be playing Premier League football? But the basis of it is that have gone in. They say about players not coming through and not going, the youngsters not going through to the England team and not, and all this sort of stuff. But they're saying that basically what they're doing is they're so lazy, and all they're interested in is 16 years of age, 17 years of age, picking up 20 grand a week, 15 grand a week, whatever else. Mm-hmm. Gets to the end of the contract, the clubs let them go, and then they're trying to find another club. But of course, the other clubs in the lower leagues won't pay them 15 grand a week, won't pay them 20 grand a week, and they end up in the conference because they're more interested in the money. Yeah. Than what they are in actually playing football.
Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I remember I had a couple of lads when I was at Grays. We had Jerram Reynolds, who was at Southend. Southend let him go. He come to me. I mean, for me, he was a very, very good player. Great attitude. He went and signed forms for Dagenham. Same with Alex Osborne. I had Alex when, I think he was 16. I chucked him in the first team at Grays. He was 16. Loved him to bits as a player. Fantastic attitude. Great attitude. He signed for Dagenham. But there is players out there, even some of the players I had at Graves, I'm not going to name, they have been at pro clubs, and then they come down and get let go, and then end up playing for me at Graves. But you can see why they get let go, because their attitude's wrong. It's all wrong. Mm. They think that football owes them a living. It's the other way around. You know what I mean? You in the day, if you're good enough and you work hard, all the rewards will come.
And so I think it's one of those things where they seem to get paid. I mean, I listen to the quotes, 16, 17 year old getting £15,000 a week, and I'm thinking, geez, I'm only getting £26,000 a year.
That
sort of thing where you think to yourself, well, surely, I mean, if someone said to some of the normal man in the street, possibly, go on, you can go and play for West Ham, or you can go and play for Arsenal, or whatever else. You probably go out there and do it for nothing.
The thing is, it is a job. And obviously everybody has to make a living. And for kids at 16, 17, I can't see if they're on 15 grand a week. You might get the one or two, the exceptions. But the others, that I mean, they're not on that money. Again, for me personally, it comes down to the apprenticeships. They should go back to the way it used to be. That they clean their boots, they used to sweep up. Well, I used to sweep the terraces when I was at Birmingham. I used to do everything. And that makes you want to achieve what the pros are having.
But so I think they were saying as well about that sort of stuff, that they don't have to do that sort of stuff.
They don't do that anymore. They haven't done it for years.
They've got their boot boy and all this sort of stuff. And I think one of them was saying, if you brought that back, then perhaps it might be a better kettle of fish, as such, with a boot player.
I think so, personally. Yeah, I really do. I think they need to have a grounding. I mean, like you said, you have about 16 year old kids. even if they're earning like $2,000 a week, I mean, that's a vast amount of money for a 16-year-old boy. I mean, I was obviously going back a long time now, like 30-odd years ago. I was earning, my first pay packet as an apprentice was £15. But I used to work from 9 in the morning to 7 at night. And on the Friday, it used to be later because we had to go to the ground. But now, like I said, you've got 17, 18-year-olds, they're jumping in Bentleys. It's incredible.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
It is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
So they got the, for me, they got no, they don't want to achieve anything in the game as long as they're getting paid. Yeah. That's what I find a lot of kids are like.
Mm. So when you started then, I mean, I did read a little bit, I mean, and I know Wikipedia's not the greatest place to look for stuff, but I mean, you can tell me right or wrong that you started off at Birmingham City.
Yep.
I mean, how did you get noticed by Birmingham City?
I was originally from Bristol, and there was a scout in Bristol named Ron Beale, who was very good friends with Ron Saunders, who was the manager of Aston Villa. And initially I went to Aston Villa for trials. At one day's training, the manager called me in the office and said, "Look, I want you to sign scoreboard forms." He said, "But this is what I want you to do." He said, "I want you to leave home. I want you to come and live in Diggs up in Birmingham. Go to school up here, and you can go on the weekends." And I've done it because obviously all I wanted to do was play football. But in that time, Ron Saunders resigned from Villa and went to Birmingham. So I went to Birmingham with Ron, and like I said, went to school up there in Birmingham. And like I said, I was guaranteed apprenticeship. I was guaranteed pro. But it didn't stop me achieving what I wanted to achieve.
I read a bit on here, and I don't know if it's true or not. You'd be able to tell me yes or no, but that there was a certain gentleman watching you when you was 11, in Bill Nicholson. Is that true?
Yeah. There's. I mean, my dad knows the story. I don't really know the story. But yeah, he told me it was true. But the thing is, when I was young, when I was about 11, 12, 13, West Ham let me go. I went to trials at West Ham, they said I wasn't big enough. Luton let me go, said I wasn't big enough. Man City let me go, said I wasn't big enough. And obviously for a 12, 13-year-old kid, it's quite devastating. But again, it made me stronger, it made me want to achieve it. Listen, for me, it doesn't matter how big you are. As long as you've got the ability, then that should all that matters, really.
I mean, how did you get over something like that, though? Because, I mean, I know, like, that we had a young lad that's actually, he played for Harlow Town, Infield Town, but he was playing for me at Waltham Abbey, in one of the youth sides for Waltham Abbey, and he'd just been let go by Tottenham. And I had heard loads of things about this young man, about how good he was, and he's a brilliant footballer and all the rest of it. And he turned up sort of the first two or three months, and there was this young lad out there, sort of 12 years of age, head down, chin on the chest. You know, everybody was against him. Everything you asked him to do, everybody was sort of like wrong. He was always right, and it was. You could see the young lad had everything completely and utterly kicked out of him. But of course, it took us a good season with him to get his head back off his chest.
Yeah.
To go on to the following year, we got sort of under 13s, and he scored 49 goals from left side of midfield.
Yeah.
You know, and he went on then to play. You know, not as high level as yourself, but he's gone on then to play for Enfield Town. He's gone on to play for Waltham Abbey, Harlow Town last season, and he's gone there. But I mean, how did you sort of pick yourself up from that?
To be honest, I was, even as a young lad, I was quite a strong person. In the day, I always knew that I would be a professional footballer. That was my goal in life. I knew I was good enough. Even at 11, 12 years old, I knew I was good enough. And it wasn't them turning around and saying, "Listen, you're not good enough." It's like, "You're too small." So when I went to Birmingham with Ron Saunders and Ron Beale, I was on a diet of steak and Guinness at 14 years old. But I lived with landlord and landlady Janet and Brian Rogers. And that was my dinner. I think I had it three times a week. So I had like a lump of steak, and I had a can of Guinness, and that was my diet, just to try and build me up.
Yeah.
But when you're little and you have to be aggressive, you have to look after yourself, and that's what I've done. But I always knew that I would make a footballer, even getting let go at certain clubs.
So I suppose it's having that right mindset yourself.
Well, you need to, because
I'm going to prove these guys completely
wrong. Because you have more lows in life than you do highs. Even as a footballer, you have more lows you do than highs. So you have to be a strong character. even like when you do make it, and like all the abuse I used to get and everything else, you have to be strong. You just have to like save water off a duck's back.
Mm. So then in 1988, then you were signed by, I think he was probably one of the most legendary managers when I was younger. It's in John Lyle, West Ham.
Yes, John. I remember John coming down to Birmingham. I got a phone call from Gary Pendry, my manager at Birmingham at the time. He said, "Oh, West Ham have come in for you. We've accepted a fee. You just got to sort your terms out." He said, "Like John Lyle and Eddie Bailey are coming down." So I went down to the ground, sat in the office. I remember John sitting there smoking. And he went, "Listen, son," he said, "I'll give you £650 a week, I'll give you £100 appearance, you have 5 minutes to think about it." I went, "5 minutes?" He went, "Yeah, 5 minutes." That was it. I went back in. I said, "Listen, I'd love to sign for West Ham." He went, "Yeah, I know you would." And that was it. That was John. And again, such an absolute gentleman, lovely, lovely fella. And like I said, I got on so well with him. It's a shame what West Ham done to him, but.
But I mean, £300,000 even back in 1988, so it seems a heck of a lot of money to have on your shoulders going there.
Yeah, but I mean, to be honest, that didn't bother me because that was nothing to do with me. I think a month before, Glasgow Rangers with Graham Souness tried to buy me for £350,000, but my chairman wouldn't let me go up there. Then obviously West Ham come in with £300,000 and that was it. So
I mean, it says here that John Lyle said that there was he's got a great touch there and I wouldn't have just signed a physical player. Do you agree with that one?
Yeah, most definitely. like I said to you, I had to be aggressive because of the players I grew up with at Birmingham. There's people like Tony Cohen, Pat Vandenay, Mark Dennis, Noel Blake, Robert Hopkins, Mick Hartford. You had to look at in training, you had to look after yourself. Otherwise, you would have got picked on. I mean, even at a young age, I was very aggressive.
Especially against Mick Hartford.
Yeah, Big Mick. I mean, I played with Big Mick and I played against Mick. Again, for me, a fantastic player, but he was strong, he was physical. So if you didn't stand up for yourself, then you would have got sorted out. But listen, I'm not being big-headed, but I could play football.
Oh, I definitely could, yeah. I used to enjoy watching you play, I must admit. Not when you played Arsenal, but I enjoyed it any other time. But this is your major debut on the 2nd of April 1988 against Sheffield Wednesday.
For West Ham, yeah. I remember signing, I think it was on the Tuesday, I could be wrong, but on the Tuesday, and I went down to Chadleigh on the Thursday, trained with the lads on the Thursday. Come Friday, we trained again in the morning. John Lyle called me in the office. He went, "Tomorrow's game." He went, "You can't play, can you?" I went, "No." And I was suspended. I knew I was suspended. He said, "I've just found out." He said, "I wouldn't have signed you otherwise." They were playing Man U that day. But then obviously next week my suspension had finished and we played Sheffield Wednesday away.
But I suppose that must have been a bit of a blow, I suppose, because if you're supposed to be Birmingham, if you was actually suspended, you would have been playing. Not Manchester United. Was that actually at Manchester United as well?
It was at Old Trafford, yeah.
At Old Trafford as well.
Yeah.
So that would have been a bit of a kick to start with.
Yeah, it would have. But again, it's like I said, as long as I was playing football, it didn't matter where it was or against what team. But yeah, I remember my debut.
So who was it you sort of, for just the second season when you was there and you started playing regularly at left back? I mean, who was the guy that you sort of ousted from left back as such? That's
well, as soon as I went there, John chucked me in the side, and that was it. There was George Parrish there, Tommy McQueen as well. But like I say, I think John pushed Georgie on a little bit, like left midfield and stuff like that. So like I say, as soon as I signed, that was it. I was playing.
As I said to you earlier, when I met George Parrish, only probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and that's the first time I'd ever met him at a charity game, you know, and a real nice guy.
Oh, lovely,
really nice
but
guy.
But going back then, it's like all the players, like when I went there in 88, all the players were really, really nice people. Mm. There was not one player there you think, "Oh, I don't like you." Mm. There was later on, but not then. They were actually fantastic.
Well, some of the legends came over here. I think Stuart Slater, Keith Rowland, and Paul Allen, and every single one of them, you know, we got me and a couple of the young sort of 14-year-old referees had been called in at the last minute, used to ref in under-10s games, and also refing Frank Bruno and Perry Groves and people like that, you know, and you're there and you've got Tony Cotty on the touchline, I've got Frank Bruno laughing in my ear, and of course it's all about confidence with anything, but it's one of those things, and you've got all these sort of ex-professionals running around on the pitch and you think, you know, blowing out all the time, but they were so supportive. I must admit, the guys from West Ham were so supportive, as well as, you know, as well as the celebs were as well on that day, because, you know, you were making mistakes because you were so nervous about all these big lads, you know, big guys that were physically running around.
It's a bit of fun, isn't it? That's it.
So I mean, what would you say then for you? I mean, what was the best game at West Ham in that sort of early period?
To be honest, it was just, like I said, I'd done a Q&A yesterday, and people asked me the same question. I can't really pick out one game. For me, it was just going out at Upton Park, playing in front of them supporters when the ground was nice and tight, that they can touch you on the back when you're taking a throw in or spit on you or whatever. But that was it, really. I mean, that's the only thing I miss about football is walking out at Upton Park in front of them supporters.
Because, I mean, I always hear people say, oh, the most passionate fans, and you always hear the likes of Newcastle being mentioned and something. But I always look at stuff, and I mean, I, again, just through being a complete novice, when you see stuff, you see the West Ham games on the TV, you even see stuff as far as the Rise of the Foot Soldier film, you know, and you look at somebody and you think, there can't be any more passionate fans than West Ham fans, surely. Do you know what I mean? You see them on the TV, you know, cheering, as you say, that it does still seem to be one of those grounds that still seems close to the pitch as well.
Yeah, I mean, like nowadays is quite far away. Like obviously when I was playing, literally from the chicken, they could touch you on the back. I remember kids offering me sweets when I'm taking throw-ins. Excuse me. And it was an absolutely fantastic place to play football.
This is here as well, that your first goal was thanks to Arsenal.
Yes.
Library.
Yeah, I think we got beat 2-1. But yeah, that's my first goal. Great, obviously, it's great to score goals, even though we got beat 2-1. It's just obviously Highbury as well, so it's fantastic to score.
Do you know? Can you remember when the first goal was at Upton Park?
No. Don't have a clue.
No, that's all right. I don't know. I was just asking whether you were. It says here then that it was a poor season of West Ham the following season when they got relegated in Division 2. And that was when West Ham decided to part company with John Lyle. Was that hard at the time?
It was for us players, and I think it was for a lot of supporters as well. It's not the case that they got rid of him, because we were struggling. It was a case they got rid of him after 30 odd years, and that was it. Like, bang, wiped their hands of him and got rid of him. They should have said, listen, John, you've done absolutely wonders for this club. Take a seat upstairs, be like on the board or anything like that. And I think a lot of players and a lot of supporters would have warmed to that, but they didn't. They just said, that's it, out you go. And for me, that's wrong, considering what he's done for that club.
I mean, at the time, I must admit, it was one of those things at the time, and I'm sitting there thinking, a bit like Man United fans must feel now without seeing Alex Ferguson there. You know, for me, even when it was sort of that time was happening, he looked at it and thought, but I've only ever known John Lyle at West Ham. Don't remember anybody else sort of being, you know, West Ham manager. Do you know what I mean? So for me, at that sort of stage, I was thinking, this feels like it's a really strange.
It was strange. When he got the sack, the place was like down in the dumps. Remember when I signed for West Ham? All I knew about West Ham was John Lyle and Billy Bonds. That's all I knew. And for him, like for John not to be there, was a. For me personally, it was a bad day for the club.
I mean, and one thing for me with West Ham, always sticks in my mind, is before your time with West Ham was 1980, when they scored that goal against Arsenal in the FA Cup final. That always sticks in my mind. That's the one thing for me. But then Lou McCarrie took over?
Yeah, Lou come in. He come in with a bit of baggage, and obviously betting against his own club to lose and stuff like that. So, to be honest, the writing was on the wall. He wasn't going to last at West Ham. I got on well with Lou, even though like we used to kick each other in the gym and everything else in the five-a-side, and he'd stop us having chips and fizzy drinks and everything else. But so I met him not so long ago as well, and yeah, some nice things to say to me. So I got on wellish with him.
I mean, he became the regular penalty taker as well.
Taking over. Well, Luke, he made me captain. He made me penalty taker, free kick taker. He made me everything. He made me captain to try and calm me down. So he said, listen, you should be playing for England. Obviously, there's reasons why you're not. We all know what they are. And he made me captain, but it didn't make no difference. At the end of the day, you are what you are. But yeah, he made me them things.
So looking back at that, do you feel now you've sort of retired from playing, do you ever regret that sort of style that you didn't ever play for England?
Not at all.
Not at all?
No. No? Really didn't bother me. There was one time that, yeah, I wanted to play for England, but that was when I was about 23, 24. After that, I really couldn't give a flying monkeys about them. Because they kept saying, oh, you're good enough. They come and watch me. I remember they come and watch me for about 12, 13 games. And it was the best stint of my career for like 12, 13 games. On the 14th game, I had a shocking game. And then in the papers, I'm not good enough. You know what I mean? So that's when I come out and say, listen, I'd rather build my dog kennels than play for England. And I meant it. If they would have picked me, I wouldn't have played.
Who was in charge at the time? Was that Bobby Robson?
No. There was Glenn Hodder was one. Right. I think Terry Venables was another.
Right.
But I remember Terry trying to buy me at Tottenham. So
yeah.
This just don't make sense.
And of course, that was then Stuart Pearce to get in front of as such.
Yeah, but...
But then again, so that would have said Stuart Pearce was the same type of sort of player as yourself.
But the thing is, I got sent off nine times. Stuart Pearce got sent off once. Mm. But I was a better player than Stuart Pearce anyway.
Fair enough. I wouldn't disagree with you. I wouldn't disagree, especially if you're sitting that close to me. But no, I wouldn't. No, I seriously wouldn't disagree with you. But I mean, with the actual penalties as well, you did quite successful with them.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember how many I took. I missed two or three, but the ones that I missed, I tried to place. And when I missed, I think it was the second one, I said, listen, I'm never going to place another one. So in the end, I just put the ball on the floor, hit it as hard as I could. I mean, professional footballers should never miss a target from 12 yards. Should never miss a target. And I didn't. So, but if you get them on target, you hit them as hard as you can, you have a very good chance of scoring.
Well, you say that, it's quite funny, because we was a game the other week. I mean, it says here that you scored 35 and missed 4, according to this, but whether that's...
Yeah, 35 sounds
but right. But we was at a game the other week, and one the Harlow Town regular penalty taker is Danny Brown, who used to play at Barnet and other places. And he, normally when he takes a penalty, I suppose a bit like yours, a bit like Stuart Pearce's, Matt Letizia's, you look away and think, oh, he scored. You know, no issues there. And I think he steps up against Chesson a few weeks ago, and at the time it was 1-1, and he's absolutely lamped this thing. Well, I think it's still going now, but it went flying over the bar.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things when he looks at him and thought, he didn't miss that, did he, surely? Because it was one of those things where you're so used to him actually scoring, you know, scoring goals all the time. It was incredible. But the first penalty success came on the 23rd of September 1989, proving to be the only goal in a win against Watford. Do you remember that one?
No.
This is a future regular captain West Ham side this season. Also saw his first captaincy in the League Cup game on the 19th of September 89 against his former club Birmingham City. And he says here, with manager Macari telling him, I'm making you captain today and I'm making you penalty taker too. And it says, Dix was often cautioned and sent off by referees. His first red card was in the match versus Wimbledon in the Football League Cup in 1989-90 season.
I got sent off before. I got sent off at Birmingham in the youth team. We were playing West Brom and I got sent off. And West Brom's youth team manager at the time was Nobby Stiles. So after the game, Nobby's come up to me, went, listen, son, he said, don't worry about it. He said, there'll be plenty more. And obviously coming from Nobby, it was good. I mean, that was the first time I think I was about 16, nearly 17. No, I was 16. I got sent off.
And was that, I mean, would you said any of the send-offs you had run lucky?
Yeah, every one of them.
Was it? was it like reputation? Would you say more of it's like some of the red cards was more reputation rather than what you
most
did?
Definitely. Yeah. I remember, I didn't get sent off this game, but I remember playing against Oxford at Oxford, and I remember one of their players standing on my chest. He absolutely just put his studs into my chest. The referee booked me. The referee booked me. And that, like, obviously then your reputation, you know your reputation is going before you. Most referees were as good as gold. Yeah, I deserve to get sent off sometimes, and obviously I think one or two I didn't deserve, but listen, it all swings in roundabouts.
So I mean, one of them here, it says it says the first red card was in a match against Wimbledon in the FA Cup, and it says it was an infamous encounter which included an on-pitch brawl between the opposing players. The fighting was sparked by a two-footed tackle by a Wimbledon player, guess who? Dennis White.
I remember the game. I think it was about a 22-man brawl. I think it was everybody chicken run as well, so they got involved as well. So, but yeah, I remember the game, and obviously I remember getting sent off.
So it was Dennis White, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen Dennis many, many times outside of football. He's a lovely fella. But listen, when you're playing, listen, I would kick my grandma. I would kick her into the chicken run if I had to. And I had some good encounters with Dennis White. But the good thing is he could kick lumps out of me. I could kick lumps out of him. After the game, we shake hands, have a drink.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, and I suppose that's what it's. Most of the time, it's what it's probably like, isn't it? I wouldn't have been trying to separate you two together. That could have been something else.
It used to be like that. I don't think it's like that anymore. I think they're like crybabies. You know what I mean? But I said, I never went out to break someone's leg or anything like that. I was there. I was physical. And St. Dennis Wise has caught me many times. even Vinny, like say Vinny Jones. I mean, I had my tussles with Vinny and everything else, but after the game, you go in the players' lounge, you have a drink, talk about life.
Mm. I mean, would you say that professional football in sort of when you was playing or now, that if there was a tackle that goes a bit naughty or whatever else, and nowadays gets sent off, do you think that sometimes players may hold that until the next time they play and give them a bit of a dig?
Yeah. Most definitely. I mean, it happened in our day. I remember playing against it was Derby, and Bobby Davison spat in my face. Now, I chased him around the baseball ground. I didn't catch him, but I was always waiting for that, for when we played him again. I never played against him again. But yeah, I mean, things like that. But when we played, players didn't really go out to really hurt players. Yeah, you had to be physical because that was the nature of the game then. But there was never any real malice tackles as such.
I think I would love to see you playing now, to see how you would react to somebody like an Ashley Young, or Cristiano Ronaldo, or somebody like that, when they were sort of like, you know, you go somewhere near them and, you know, they jump on the floor, and all of a sudden, because of your reputation, someone thinks you've given them a bit of a lump.
The thing is, I would give them a lump in the first 5 minutes. I would smash them that hard that they wouldn't come back. They wouldn't come nowhere near me. Because, obviously I've played against people like Ryan Giggs and people like that, who are fantastic players, in Franz Carr and Tony Daly and people like that. And you look at these players now, I mean, they wouldn't even, if you had a bad reputation, they wouldn't even come near you. Because, like you said, with Ashley Young, they're girls. Mm. I mean, going down like he does is absolutely disgraceful. Mm. I mean, Ronaldo is a bit different. I mean, Ronaldo's an absolute awesome footballer. And he goes over, but not that easy. Mm. But Ashley Young, I mean, if I was his manager, I think it's absolutely disgraceful, to be honest with you.
I mean, talking about Ronaldo, just off yourself for a minute, but I mean, one of the conversations that always pops up in my youth soccer show is, who's the best, Ronaldo or Messi? Now, I always settle for Ronaldo, because I said to people, well, with Ronaldo, he's done it in Portugal, he does it for Portugal, he's done it in this country, he's done it in Spain, where Messi's got all the best players in the world around him, and has only done it in Spain. You know, 9 times out of 10, you hear people saying that Argentina's sort of public don't necessarily love him as much as the Barcelona people do, because he doesn't necessarily always do it for Argentina.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. I would, if it was my side, I'd have Ronaldo over Messi. Like you said, he has done it in England and he has done it abroad, but just his all-round play. I mean, you pick the ball up, he's got bundles and bundles of skill. I'm not saying Messi hasn't, but Messi obviously is a goal scorer. But for me, Ronaldo can do everything. Like he's good at heading, or he can tackle, but he's good when he's dribbling the ball. He chases back. He works hard. So if it was me, I would definitely have Ronaldo.
And I think as well, when you see the likes of Messi, well, I'd love to see Messi up against someone like yourself or someone, you know, like the Ryan Shaw crosses, and, mm-hmm. and these are, you know, the Blackburns, the Stoke Cities, the teams that you know you're going to go out there and get a bit of clumping. Would he be able to handle that like Ronaldo did, you know, if he physically ever came over here, which I know he never will, but if he ever did?
Obviously, I mean, if he come over here now, he'd be fine. I mean, because obviously they can't tackle or anything like that. But looking like Aguero, I think Aguero's an absolutely fantastic player. The games I've seen him play, me, he's awesome. He deals with it. He's, what's he, about 5'5", quite stocky. But yeah, I'm sure Messi could, because it's not, when you're a striker and you're small, I mean, they have such good movement. You know, you look at Aguero, his movement off the ball is just incredible. Mm. And people don't really get that close to him. And I think obviously Messi would be the same. Mm. But Ronaldo, I mean, Ronaldo's a big bloke and he's ripped. You know, I would have thought he could look after himself.
Oh, definitely. Pitch. Yeah. Back to yourself. It says here that after that sort of season we were talking about, finished seventh in the season, which saw Lou Macari go and Billy Bonds come in.
Yes.
I suppose that must have been, not being unfair to Lou Macari, but I suppose another sort of West Ham legend coming in to look after the club. Would you have said that would have been hard for him to look up to run the team, or
no,
because of his reputation with West Ham, or do you think that would have been a benefit for him?
For Billy, me personally, I don't think he wanted the manager's job. He was there with the youth team. Billy's an absolute icon at West Ham. The fans love him. The players loved him for what he was. He was a really, really nice bloke. Like, so not the most gifted player in the world, but he wore his heart on his sleeve 100% every single game. And we were all happy that he got the job, because we all have utmost respect for Billy. But the thing with Billy was an absolute fitness fanatic. I mean, at 42 years old, he's still the fittest man I've ever played football with. And I hated running. And I mean, hated running with a passion. With no football in my foot, I hated it. And we clashed a lot, me and Billy. Nearly come to blows after one game. But again, from my side, is like the utmost respect for him, utmost.
So, from one legend to another, did you ever get to meet Bobby Moore?
Yes, Bobby Moore. Yeah, I met him a few times. And there was a time that I got sent off about three times in about 20 games, and everybody was jumping on the bandwagon saying I'm a thug, I'm this, I'm that, even including my own managers were doing it. And the only person that really stuck up for me was Bobby Moore. Because he used to do the radio upstairs at West Ham, and he called me over. And he said, "Listen," he said, "What's happening?" He said, "Listen, it'll all pass." He said, "It'll all pass. It'll all go." And I had a good chat with him, and he was right. But to obviously speak to someone like Bobby Moore is fantastic.
Was you at West Ham when he passed away?
Yeah, I was at West Ham. Yeah,
it must have been a tough time for everybody.
Well, of course it is. I mean, when any footballer dies or things like that, it's hard to take, especially if they're an icon at your club. Obviously, with Bobby, he's had cancer and he's suffered for a long time. But again, like I said, not just at West Ham, but in football in general, he's an icon everywhere. Mm. I mean, he's the only English person to lift the World Cup. And again, for me, lovely fella, always immaculately dressed, absolutely incredible, never hair out of place or anything like that. And again, obviously he'd be sorely missed it at West Ham, and he still is.
Well, it's funny, I mean, my two daughters are 18 and 14, but if I ever sit down and watch that Escape to Victory, the only person they know on there are the footballers, mm-hmm. is Bobby Moore.
Yeah.
Every time. Oh, that's Bobby Moore, isn't it, Dad? Mm. He won the World Cup, didn't he? You know, they don't necessarily know too much else about football, but they know that that's who that is. Mm-hmm. You know, every time the actual, every time the film gets watched, and I must admit, gets watched regularly as well. But it says that in the 1991 season, that saw the start of your injury problems. So one of the games they put down is the game against Bristol City.
Yeah, I didn't have injury problems. I had two major injuries. And the one was at Bristol City. I remember going up for a header, and years ago, it used to be the pitch, then it used to be the running track. And there's about probably a 7-inch difference. I mean, I remember half of my foot going off in half knot, and it, I felt something snap in my leg, but it wasn't painful. We had about 10 minutes and I carried on in things like that, and I knew something wasn't right. The next day, my knee was, oh, it was like a football. It was just ballooned up. So obviously went and seen my physio. We had the club surgeon at the time, was, his name was Roper. So I went under the knife, and as I come round, he said, I took all your cartilage out. He said, your anterior, your posterior, your lateral ligament, he said, they were all exploded. He said, but they were an old injury, so I left them. So I'm thinking, right, well, you're the surgeon, you know what you're doing. Come back, I think we played Ipswich in the reserves, or someone like that. Come back, and I lasted about 4 minutes. 4 minutes, that was it. My knee just went again. And luckily enough, we had a new physio come in, name of John Green. And he said, your knee is totally, totally gone. He didn't put it like that, he swore. But he said, like, I said, I'm not going to Roper again. I said, never in a million years am I seeing that man again. And there was Billy was still the manager. He said, listen, he said, he's a club surgeon, you've got to go and see him. I said, listen, I would pay for myself to go and see someone else. I am not going to see him. I said, he's just wrecked my career because he didn't do my injury. So I went, me, John Green, went and seen a surgeon named John King up in the London Independent. And he was quite blunt, which I like people to be. He said, your knee is totally gone. That's it. And he said, you're going to be out for 14 months. And that was it. I was out for 14 months to the day. And luckily enough, I got back playing and it was fine. But obviously, I had to work at it. And that was it. And for another 4 or 5 years, I had like a few operations in between. We had to clean the knee up and everything else. Now, my second one was when I was about 27, 28.
So you must have been going stir crazy in that 14 months. Well, somebody like yourself that's that passionate about playing football, yeah. You must have been really hard.
The thing, that's why I took up golf. I was quite bitter, and I was just going down the pub every night, just getting absolutely smashed. So I went and seen the surgeon again. He said, look, you can come and see me anytime. So I went and seen him. I said, I've got to do something. I said, I'm bordering on being an alcoholic. So I'm just going down the pub day after day after day. He said, listen, go and play golf. I went, nah, it's an old man's game. He went, no, because I had a big brace on my leg. He said, you can't do any damage. He said, the walking and the twisting will do it good. And that's it. That's how I started to play golf.
And now a good golfer.
Well, I was. I haven't hit a ball for 4 years. Again, my knee is totally shot to pieces, for golf anyway.
And again, there must be hard to take as well, because you've lost your football career, lost your football.
Well,
you know,
to be honest,
I
don't miss the golf. No. But I, like I said, I miss football every day.
I don't miss the golf either, I must admit, I'm always hunting around for the balls in the bushes. I must admit, even when I do go with a father-in-law, I must admit. So, I mean, you then came back, started playing again for West Ham. I mean, can you remember what your first game back was after
my first one, it was Sheffield United. We drew 1-1. I give the goal away. Then we got a penalty, which I ended up taking.
And it says here, and I think this must have been what you were talking about earlier on, about the run of sort of games being sent off at Newcastle with Franz Carr.
And, I remember elbowing Franz Carr up at Newcastle, and when I elbowed him, I just started walking because I knew the referee was coming over to get his card out. So I started walking. I got sent off against Arsenal, against Ian Wright. Talking of diving, he dived. I've told him that a couple of times, and I can't remember who the other team was.
They said there was no friction between the two. This was Franz Carr. No friction between the two players with Dick Sand. The incident, not to this day, I don't know why I did it. I had to had it in my mind that I was going to elbow him, and then it was bang. Only four games passed before he was dismissed again in a game against Wolves.
Yeah, Steve Ball, Paul Birch.
Yeah. Dick's clash with Paul Birch and Steve Ball before being sent off, with Billy Bonds having to stop him from attacking. Birch, who was still on the ground. Is that true?
Well, no, it's not. Well, I can remember, the picture is, there's Steve Ball's on the floor and Birchie's coming across, and I'm just about to, not hit him, but I'm standing over him. I can see Billy running up. So yeah, I mean, it's fantastic. Good old days.
Well, it says it barely 3 months passed before his third dismissal of the season in January 93 after two bad fouls on Derby County midfielder Ted McMinn.
Yeah, yeah. I remember him.
And he said he was sent off having to be escorted from the pitch by teammate Clive Allen.
Well, like, the thing is, yeah, I went in, but he jumped even before I touched him, and he fell on the floor and he's holding his leg. I didn't even touch him. That's what gave me the ump. If I'd have caught him, then fine, but yeah. I didn't.
That must be, yeah. I mean, again, that reputation thing again, isn't it? I suppose. Mm-hmm. It must be
the thing is, Ted McMinn, he could dish it out as yeah. well. And, like, say, years ago, if you were down and you stayed down, you were injured.
Mm.
But obviously it started to creep in that, yeah, people just dive. And
who would you say was the first person to start that then? In your thoughts, I mean, you know, from what you've seen playing wise, was it somebody?
Klinsmann was one. I remember slapping him across the face. <'Cause> I remember I kicked him and he squealed like a pig. And I hardly had touched him. And he's in my face, so I slapped him across the face, and I thought he was going to cry. But I think, don't get me wrong, he was a fantastic player. But he was one of the first ones.
It says that despite the dismissals, he played 34 league games, a possible 46 in promotion season, scored 11 goals, placing third in the list of the highest goal scorers for the season, behind only Clive Allen and Trevor Morley.
Mm-hmm.
Must have been proud of that.
Yeah,
he's been left back as well, and you know. And still being third goal scorer.
Well, the thing is, when I first started my football career at Birmingham professionally, I was a striker. When I was younger, I was always a striker. And the day it came to play left back was when I was at Birmingham. We didn't have a left back. Our left back was injured. And the manager at the time said, "Who wants to play left back?" And I went, "Yeah, I'll play left." Put my hand up. "Well, yeah, I'll play left back." Mm. And that was it. I played left back, and I stayed there ever since. So I do. In my mind, I still thought I was a striker and everything else. But when you're playing at the back, you can see everything in front of you. Mm. So when you get the ball, yeah, I used to love running with the ball. And I just used to love shooting as well. So
that's you what finish I it as well.
Yeah, the thing is, it's all about timing. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's not rocket science. It's just about timing.
The next bit there, it says now playing in the Premier League for the first time. West Ham struggled in the first 11 games. New signing Simon Webster says had a long-term injury, having his leg broken by Dix in a training session.
But when, like, in the papers, it was like, I meant it. Mm. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous. Even when you're saying it like that, it seems like I meant it. But, like, yeah, Simon come. Remember, we played a five-a-side, and all it was a block tackle. Yeah. We've both gone in. I've got the ball. I've gone on and scored in the five-a-side. Simon's lying on the floor. So obviously we've gone over and see what. And obviously the physio come out, John Green, took him in and said, "Look, he's broke his leg." Absolutely devastated. Yeah, I broke my teammate's leg or anybody's leg. Mm. But it was. But when you see it in the paper that I've smashed him, I've done this, I've done that, and it wasn't the case.
And it must be. You must look at that and think. Yeah, reputation. I was going to say something. I couldn't say that. But you've got that sort of reputation, and you think, why put this something like this out here? Because again, you know, people think, oh, you know.
But the thing is, like a week later, is it? I've ended his career.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And people look at it and go, yeah, he is a thug. He is this. He is that. And it wasn't the case.
It really must be frustrating.
At times.
This is I'm just literally just reading as it says, fellow new signee Dale Gordon had failed to make the impression on the side his transfer is intended. We've decided now managed by Harry Redknapp. I mean, what was it like playing for Harry?
I love playing for Harry.
Yeah.
I still speak to Harry now. Best man manager I've played under. Just made you feel the best player in that position. Mm. And like I said, I got on really well with him. Again, I had my rise with Harry and everything else, like all my managers. But again, he took West Ham to a next level when he ended up finishing, I think, sixth or seventh. And like I said, for me, good manager, good coach, good manager.
So how did the transfer then come around from West Ham to Liverpool?
Well, it was, I think it was the Derby game when I got sent off. I think it was 94. When you get sent off, you're not allowed to come back out in the ground. Mm-hmm. So you got to stay in the dressing room. But I didn't. I come out and sat in the dugout. And obviously the fans seeing me started singing my name. So we come back in, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, and Harry said to me, he went, listen, he said, if you want to go to Liverpool, I can get you a move. But Billy was still the manager at the time. Harry was assistant. And I thought, well, obviously, if you want me to go, there's something wrong. So I went, listen, I'll go. And that was it. I went and met Graham Souness, who I loved to bits, is a manager. Absolutely fantastic for me. And that was it. I signed for Liverpool. That was on Tuesday, I think. I went up, saw him on the Thursday, signed on the Friday, played on the Saturday.
You must have, I mean, I don't know, because I know you're a West End man through and through, but it's one of those things where you're looking at, you must have been elated when you got somebody like Liverpool coming for you.
Well, Graham tried to buy me when he was at Rangers, obviously went back in 88. Obviously this was 94. Listen, Liverpool, obviously one of the biggest clubs in the world. Wherever you go, I went to Malaysia with Liverpool, doing the Masters, come out of the airport 2 o'clock in the morning, the airport's full of Liverpool supporters and Man United supporters. Mm. It's absolutely incredible. But to go to Anfield and go in the trophy room in absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Because there was a Liverpool's Legends match during the weekend, I think, wasn't there, over in South Africa?
Yeah.
And they were talking about that it was just mental, the amount of tickets that they'd actually sold for it, and these were like legends that were going out there to play. And I know they were talking, I think Mark Wright was talking about it on the radio as well, and he was saying about, it's just crazy.
Liverpool are global.
It's just incredible. Yeah. You know, to come and see like the legends, not even the first team, but the legends going out there. And he said, literally, I think they'd, you know, packed out the whole stadium to go and play one of these South African first teams. And I think you were saying about the average age, I think they had one person under 40, and I think the other team had about six or seven players under 25. He said, we could be running forever.
Well, I played in a couple of them, and we played one down in Bristol for Nicky Tanner's team, who was obviously ex-Liverpool. And yeah, we played their first team. They had like kids 18, 19, 20 running past you. So again, you have to leave your foot out, give them a little kick, remind them that we're old and we can't run. Liverpool are a global side. Mm. And for me to sign for them, I only played 28 games, absolutely fantastic honour.
But again, I mean, it says here, in the week the swap deal, which involved David Burrows, Mike Marsh moving to West Ham, and they had extra money to buy Lee Chapman.
Yeah.
So that shows what a quality football player you are, or were, whichever way you want to put it, and the same sort of situation of how much Liverpool really wanted you as well.
Yeah, like I say, I think it was Graham Souness. Obviously, I think people say I'm his kind of player, because obviously he was very aggressive again, but absolutely fantastic player. And I think the deal worked out about $2.5 million, I think, but it kept West Ham in that Premiership, because they obviously got David Burrows, who's a good player, Mike Marsh, very good player, but then they obviously bought Lee Chapman as well. but it kept him in the Premiership, so it was good deals from all round, really.
And a defence with you and Neil Ruddock.
Me and Razor, yeah. Me and Razor. Well, I get on well with Razor, very well.
He comes across, whenever you see him on the TV or whatever else, he just does come across as being a real, you know, quality guy.
He's very, very loud.
Yeah.
I mean, I've watched him do his after dinner speaking for Help the Heroes and everything, and he's quite blue, but he's good. He's good fun.
He couldn't have made your debut in a better game though, could you, for Liverpool?
No, Everton. Goodison. Yeah, it was. I remember Tony Carter was playing obviously for Everton. I think we got beat 2-0, something like that. But yeah, I mean, like I said, my full debut for Birmingham was against Aston Villa. See, my full debut for Liverpool was against Everton. So a couple of local derbies there. Yeah, it was a great game, but obviously we got beat. So
according to this, it says you made a mistake to let Cotty score. If that's the case, does he wind you up about it?
No, no, I'd smash him. No, what it was, I mean, I had the ball and TC was coming into me, so I just tried to knock the ball round him, and he got the ball and he went and scored. So
And I didn't realise as well that was the memorable game with Mr. McManaman and Grobbelo giving each other a bit of a
jig. Yeah, like someone asked me about that the other day as well, and I forgot all about it. I remember Bruce saying something to Steve, and Steve answering him back, and then just squaring up to each other, and they started poking. I just stood there laughing.
Well, is that funny enough? I think it was on that Premier League years, I think. It was only on yesterday or the day before, and I was actually sitting watching it. I didn't realise that was the first thing. But it says, by now, in a Liverpool side, Dick scores his opening goal, a shot 25 yards in a 3-0 away win at Oldham Athletic in January 1994.
Yes, I remember it. I think Jamie passed me the ball, Jamie Redknapp, and again, like I said, 25 yards, just hit it, and it lucky enough, it flew top corner. So that was my first goal.
And then, of course, Graham left, or was given the tic-tac, whichever way you want to say it. Yeah. Then it was taken with Ian Rush and John Barnes.
No, well,
he dropped fans' favourite. Sorry, Ian Rush and John Barnes to the reserves, and became sort of unpopular. So who came after that? Was that Roy Evans?
Roy Evans
coming after.
Well, Roy was already there. So Roy was obviously he was there as a coach. In the end, I had big falls out with him. When I was there, he was a coward, and that was it really. The writing was on the wall when he got the manager's job. He didn't like me and I didn't like him. And that was it. It's just a case of waiting to see the clubs come in for me.
I was reading as well that a very sort of memorable day for me, and it ended up being a memorable day for you, and I only realised this last night when I was sort of like looking up on the internet about different bits and bobs about yourself and stuff, that you scored the last ever goal in front of the standing cop on the 9th of April 1994. And it just happens to be a memorable day for me because that's when I got married on that day.
Right.
So that's why it sort of stuck in my mind when I saw it. So I mean, what was that like, scoring that?
Well, obviously you don't realise at the time. You know the standing cop's going to get pulled down the day after. But it doesn't go through your mind. But like now when you're looking back, I mean, right, I was only there 28, I played 28 games, scored 3 goals. You had Ian Rush there, who was an absolute prolific goal scorer, and obviously Robbie Fowler as well. It scored, I don't know, probably 500-600 goals between them, and I'm there scoring the last goal for the Stanley Cup. And obviously I'll always be in their record books, which is nice.
Fantastic.
Which is nice.
And that must have been fantastic, though, playing behind those. I mean, playing behind the likes of Ian Rush and Robbie Fowler. Yeah. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, two of the best strikers of all time.
Yeah, I mean, I played with some good players at Liverpool. John Barnes used to play in front of me. I mean, Barnes, he was an absolutely fantastic footballer. Even though when I went there, he was getting on and he couldn't really go past people, but he never gave the ball away. Everything was nice and simple. Absolutely fantastic. Ian Rush, again, prolific goal scorer. Robbie is probably the best finisher I've ever seen and played with, but again, it's like play with Bruce Grobbelaar, Rob Jones, Mark Wright, Steve McManaman, obviously Jamie, Ronnie Whelan, Steve Nicol. I mean, playing with some of them players, absolutely dream. Like, you know, you go out and you're thinking, look at all these players.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's incredible.
I mean, one of the things with Liverpool, I suppose, when one of the players at Liverpool, it always did surprise me a little bit, and I know he's a very good player, but it was one of those ones at the time you thought, one of those sort of transfers you looked at and you thought, really? Was when Steve McManaman went to Real Madrid. For me, that was a real sort of like,
he was a good player though, Steve.
Yeah.
I mean, a real good player. Another fit as you like. Again, giving the ball, if you want a bit of breathing space, giving the ball, and you just go and wander with the ball. But absolutely, for me, a privilege to play with him. He was a very, very good player.
And it says here that the last game he played was an away defeat to Aston Villa for Liverpool, anyway, on the 7th of May 1994.
So it says, I don't remember.
I mean, it says here as well that this, I mean, this has got to be, I think it's massive feather in your cap for this one, when he says here that Souness had actually said, he said your Liverpool career only lasted for 13 months, a short time considering that his former manager Graham Souness had said of Dix, if I was to pick the best 11 players I've ever worked with, he'd be one of them.
I mean, that's a great honour. And it's, I mean, it's nice to know these things. And the other thing is Maradona in his book. I was in the top 100 players.
Wow.
I mean, it's absolutely incredible. Like I said, I did have a reputation, and obviously the away supporters and things like just look at him and say, well, he's a thug, he's this, that and the other. But when you get fellow professionals saying this is how good he was, it's absolutely fantastic.
So did you ever play against Maradona?
No.
No, you didn't get the chance to play against him?
No, played against him,
So then, I suppose, if you're going to leave Liverpool, was there any one club he was ever going to go back to?
If they come in for me, of course. Yeah. I remember Roy Evans calling me in the office. He went, sit down. He went, Tottenham are coming for you. So I got out of my chair. I went, no chance. And he went, no, I'm serious. I went, so am I.
Exactly what I would have done.
I would, no chance. I'm not. He went, well, why? I said, well, West Ham, Tottenham. He said, just don't happen.
Yeah.
I said, I know players that have gone from West Ham to Tottenham, and it's not nice what they go through. I said, but I'm not going to Tottenham. Never in a million years. And I think about a week, month later, he's called me and he said, listen, West Ham want you. I went, yep, now we're talking. he said, so you just got to sort out a deal, and that was it. So
I mean, was it true then that Harry read that commented that he believed that his chairman thought he was off the rocker because you was considerably heavier than when you'd left for Liverpool a year earlier? Was that something that someone just made up and written on Wikipedia?
No, I don't think I was heavier. They couldn't believe that Harry was getting me back because of like, all the problems I caused. I mean, I would row with Harry about anything and Billy about anything in training and stuff like that. But this Harry knew what he was getting back.
This is here as well. He said that your first game back was the 22nd of October 1994. So a 2-0 home win against Southampton, and in keeping with your reputation, Dix was booked.
Yeah, but the thing is, when I was at Liverpool, I got booked once in 28 games. Well, as soon as I come back to West Ham, first game I got booked. So for me, that just proves it. Players at bigger clubs get more benefit of the doubts because I only got booked once.
Yeah. Well, it does. I suppose it does in a way when you think about it. Didn't think about it like that, but one in 28 games, but then one in one as soon as you come back.
Exactly. And I didn't change my game at Liverpool.
He says you played a major part in helping keep West Ham in the Premier League in 94-95, scoring 5 goals. The 1996 season saw him equal the highest goal scorer with Tony Cotty for West Ham in the Premier with 10 league goals. And in 1996-97, he scored 2 in the crucial London derby against Tottenham on the 24th of February 97 at the Bowling Ground. That must have been fantastic.
Yeah, it was. Obviously, when Tottenham play West Ham at Upton Park, it's an absolute electrifying place to play football. And it was absolutely bucketing down with rain. It was really windy and everything else. And I think we just got John Artson and Paul Kitson. My first one was a header, and the second one was a penalty. And we beat them 4-3. But like, to beat Tottenham, obviously they're a big rival of West Ham's and stuff like that, but to beat them, it was absolutely fantastic.
He says the game, that was the first win in 9. And it was the game was significant, the start of a fantastic fight back by West Ham to avoid relegation that year.
Yeah, I mean, Harry brought in Johnny Artson, who was a fantastic player, in Paul Kitson. Mm-hmm. I mean, they kept us up with their goals and everything else. And you had two players up there that could lead a line. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they were a massive help to us.
And then another knee injury that made you miss the whole of 97-98.
I was out for 18 months. The club tried to... I think I had about a 3-year contract left, and the club tried to fob me off with 6 months' money. And I went, listen, ain't going to happen. So you either pay my contract up, or I'm going to go and get my knee sorted. And I went to America with my physio, John Green. I went to America to see a bloke called Jim Cannon, who used to do all the American footballers and baseball players. Obviously, they have bad injuries. Yeah. And he looked at mine, he said, yeah, he said, I can do it. He said, but you'll have a 1 in 10 chance to play again. I went, as long as I've got a chance, that'll do. And it was, but because I knew from my first injury what to expect, it wasn't so bad, even though I was gutted because I was out for 18 months. And it was a long, long road back. But again, I had a physio, John Green, who was there with me through thick and thin. I used to call him everything because he used to push me so hard. But without him and my surgeon, John King, I would never have made it back.
Yeah. So it's him, realistically, you've got to thank for extending your career.
Well, both of them, yeah. Both, yeah. John Green, yeah. And John King, yeah. Mm.
It says, literally, that you came back. It says, West, so we're reading literally what it says here. He did return to action in 1998-99 season. West Ham finished fifth to qualify for the UEFA Cup, but his injury problems failed to go away and was restricted to just 9 Premier League games. West Ham then terminated the contract and he retired professional football after 14-year career, 11 years of which he spent at West Ham in two spells. So was that a joint decision between you and West Ham, or was that just saying it came completely out of the blue for you?
Well, what it was, we played Charlton away, and I knew the writing was on the wall because Harry played me left wing back, and I never played there, even when I was fit, I never played there. So I knew that he was trying to get me out the way. And I played, and I had a stinking game. It was just awful. And I think the next game was at Newcastle, and Harry called me in the office. He said, look, you're going to sit on the bench. I went, I'm not sitting on any bench. He said, I'm not going all the way to Newcastle to sit on the bench. I said, you either sort my, if you want me to retire, sort my contract out, then we'll call it quits. And in the end, they did. And then obviously I got my testimonial. But I mean, that day was the worst day of my life.
What a testimonial.
Testimonial, because I knew that was the last time that I would ever play at Upton Park in a game. Okay, I've been back and played in like five sides and stuff like that, but that day I knew that it was final. And it was. I mean, it's quite emotional for me. But listen, all good things come to an end.
Mm. Well, since you played 315 competitive games for West Ham, scoring 64 goals. And your final appearance for West Ham came against Arsenal on the 6th of February 1999, and your final goal came against Swansea in the FA Cup on the 2nd of January 1999. Was that a penalty or was that a goal?
No, that was against Swansea. Was a shot. I think it bounced about 5 times, went under the goalkeeper. But I remember, I think the Arsenal, I think we got beat 4-0, I think. But yeah.
So it says on the bottom here, there's a little paragraph on it. It says, in 2000, Dix was granted a testimony match by West Ham on the 30th of August 2000. As West Ham 11 took on a Spanish side, Atletico Bilbao, up to part. The game was marred by a 17-player brawl in which West Ham player Igor Stimic was booked for a bad tackle. West Ham captain for the day, Paolo Di Canio, slapped several Spanish players in the face. West Ham manager Harry Redknapp was ordered to remove Di Canio from the pitch to defuse the tension. I won't even attempt to read who the Bilbao coach was, but he was asked to remove as well. Playing for the same reason, but Bilbao 1-2-1.
Yeah, I mean, it was. It's my testimony. I remember, because what was supposed to happen was I was supposed to go on maybe 20 minutes from the end and just come off when the game finished. But Harry, being Harry, put me on, then pulled me off when the game was still going. And obviously, I went in, sat in the dressing room, and I remember as I was in there, Paolo come in. He went, I'm so sorry, sir, I've been sent off. I went, mate, don't worry about it. I said, it's my testimonial, you can do what you want. But he was absolutely gutted that he got sent off in my testimonial. But I loved it. It was just one of them things. And like I say, looking back and he's slapping players and things like that. That's the part.
So what was he... Well, I mean, Paolo Di Canio, I mean, we see what you see on the TV with him and all the rest of it. And I mean, there's so many people say bad things against him. But every time I see him on there, you can't ask for a more passionate...
No, but there's passion and there's passion. I mean, like I said, again, I speak to Paolo now and then. I'd done a thing, ambulance down when he was at Swindon. And I was sat in the room with him, something like this. I was sat in the room with him for about 45 minutes. I come out, I was knackered when I come out because he's on his feet for 45 minutes. He's kicking every ball, his arms are going everywhere and he's shouting and screaming and things like that. But that's him.
Yeah.
It's not... Like you said, when obviously Sunderland beat Newcastle and you see him sliding up and down, it's not put on. That is what he's like. For me, that's over the top, but that is him.
Yeah.
And people either take it or they don't. And he is. I mean, he's very, very passionate. Mm. But sometimes you have to, like everything, like your anger and things, you have to curb it sometimes, but Paolo can. But he is what he is.
I mean, it always makes me laugh, though. I mean, the kids, because my daughter's there. A young referee, she's 18 now, but one of the things that she did see, and I think it's one of the things they showed us in when we went for our referees sign off, was of course Paolo Di Canio and the pushing thing, and it was just amazing how that all these young referees and older referees that were sort of sitting there for their final test, and you got shown this clip, you know, and everybody just laughed.
Yeah.
You know, and it just shows you what.
Well, it was funny. You know, it was Paul Alcock,
yeah.
wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he should never have fallen over. No. It was like Ashley Young, isn't he?
I think the funniest part about all of it, though, was when Nigel Winterburn went up to challenge you, but then he sort of went towards you and, but no, I ain't having none of that, and walked off, which was quite funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in 2001, and you made a brief return, we touched on it earlier on, and went back to play for one of the local clubs in Canby Island.
Yeah, I knew Jeff. And my agent, Rachel, at the time, knew Jeff. Like I said, I had a few months, well, a year or two out of professional football, and I thought, yeah, my knee feels good. I just want to play football. And that's all I ever wanted to do. So I thought I'd go back and try. And again, I played 12 games for Canby. We had a good cup run. Like I said, we beat Wigan at Wigan 1-0. We beat Northampton at home. Then I was injured. Then the boys went. We all went to Burnley, and we got beat 4-1. But I mean, absolutely fantastic cup run, and I really, really enjoyed my time. It can be under Jeff and Glenn Pennyfather.
Mm. And then I suppose that's just one of the highlights we haven't touched on it. I suppose we should really. You played for the England under 21s with Paul Gascoigne and stuff. I mean, what was that? What was it like playing with somebody like him?
He's the best player I've ever played with, Gazza. Absolute fruitcake, but because at the time in the under 21s, I mean, Dave Sexton was the manager, and you had to share a room. Obviously, like, it ain't like it is now, but we had to share a room. And I remember him saying, "Who wants to share with Gazza?" And no one put their hands up. So I went, "Listen, I'll share with him." And it was absolutely incredible. I remember it's about 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm fast asleep. And what he's done, he's put the room was just two single beds, cupboard in the middle, and a toilet. I remember he put some firecrackers underneath the toilet seat and lit them, and they exploded everywhere. I was in bed, obviously asleep, naked. I thought it was a bomb. So I've got up, ran out the room, run down the corridor with no gear on. And he stood at the door just laughing, and all the other players and like directors and that, they're all at the door, and I'm just stood there with no clothes on. And he thought it was hilarious. But another one, he's the nicest fellow you wish to meet. Really,
I mean, you can see why, you know, when he had his issues just recently, you can see why a lot of people sort of came to his, you know, even probably players that never ever played with him, the likes of Jack Wiltshire and people that had never been anywhere that actually had the honour of playing with him, all sort of came together as a, you know, as a football family and said, look, we're going to put this in and help him out. You can physically see, because whenever you see him, he seems to be a really nice guy.
He is a really nice fellow. Like, he'll give you his last £5 note if he had to, you know what I mean? He's one of them. But again, he's as mad as a box of frogs, seriously. Properly mad, but again, lovely fella.
So, I mean, when was it you actually decided then to give up at Canby and go into management?
Well, it wasn't, because I never really planned to go into management or coaching. I was quite bitter that I had to retire when I was 29. So I had, like I said, apart from Canby, I had a few years out of the game, and obviously over the years it just keeps eating you, and you just want to get back involved. And like I said, I went and managed Wibbeno. I said, but bloke rung me up and said, listen, the manager has left, he's nicked all the money, all the players have gone, can you come and help us? And I was living in Spain at the time, so it wasn't like it was down the road. So I ended up living with my in-laws who lived in Braintree, and went to Wibbeno. And what it was, the object was just to keep them in that division, which we did. We kept them in the division quite comfortably in the end. And it was only till the end of the season that was it. So at the end of the season come, kept them in the division, because I wasn't getting paid, and some of the players, most of the players weren't getting paid. So it was good. I enjoyed it, and that really spurred me on to do management and coaching.
And then from there you went to Grays.
I went to Grays, yeah. I was at Grays for about 20 months. Many ups and downs at Grays. As I said earlier, like with Mickey Woodward and Andy Swallow, got on fantastic with them. And a lot of the players were fantastic as well. I mean, but some of the players, well, a lot of the players weren't good enough to play in the conference. And they were all on contracts from the previous manager. And they're not going to go anywhere else because they're not going to get the money they were getting at Grays.
Yeah.
So they were just happy to come in, train, and go home and not bother playing. Because at the end of the day, you, as a manager, you've got to try and pick your best side, obviously, to win the games. And a lot of the players weren't good enough at all.
So what was, is it something that you can talk about in the reasons why Rays were so in conference and then down to Rahman North?
Well, we got relegated, obviously, because we weren't good enough. And they took voluntary relegation, obviously, financially. As people know, it's tough in non-league football.
Yeah.
So they took voluntary relegation, but even like 3 weeks before the season started, we didn't know if we were in like the Essex Senior League or the Rahman North. We didn't even know. So yeah, you haven't got long time to get your team together. So if you're in the Essex Senior League, you have to get team to play at that division.
Yeah.
Or if you're in the Rahman North, you have to get players to play at that division. And again, about 3 weeks before the season started, they said, right, you're in the Rahman North Division 1. So we had to go and find all players. We only had about two or three players left from the previous year, because they want to play as high as they can. I understand that, but for most of them, that was probably their level.
So I mean, how did it go? And once you got your players together, was it? Did you find that hard because you've got the players, not necessarily the players you'd necessarily want, because you've been put into higher division than maybe you'd win.
It was difficult in the beginning, because obviously you had to go, like the first few games, I think our first game was against Harlow.
Oh, okay.
I think so. Yeah. At Grace. East Thurrock it was. Yeah. That's where we ground shared. It was difficult. So over the course of the season, you had to get different players in and but a lot of players seeing Grays is like a gravy train, because Grays had a little bit of money, not loads of money, and players just wanted to come there because they go, "Wang, yeah, I'll get this or I'll get that."
Yeah.
And me as a manager, it's not about money. Mm-hmm. It's about wanting to play for a club. We had some really good players for that level, but underachieved for whatever reason. I mean, I know what footballers are like. They make excuses for everything and everybody.
And it finished, what, 10th that year?
Yeah, I think it was 9th for 10th,
So, and then you sort of left in 2011. So, and then it says here as well, which is, I didn't even know this. It says Julian took charge of Sealand's side.
Yeah, but that was only like a tournament over in Yarra Man.
Yeah.
It was only three or four games. I'd had one training session before. I didn't know any players, so I just went there and basically just wanted a bit of professional coaching. But again, they were playing teams that were far superior than them. And I think the first game, I think we got beat. I think it was 3-2 or 4-2. They'd done well the first game, but they only took, they had 12 players. The first game, you got two players that got injured, so we got 10 players. So players are playing with injuries, and it shouldn't be. So obviously it wasn't organised very good. Next team who won the tournament, we got beat 6-7-0. And the last game we won 2-1, but I enjoyed it. Like most of them are a nice bunch of lads. But again, if you're going to tournaments, you've got to be prepared. You can't just turn up, not train for a month, and think you're going to go there and do well. It just doesn't happen like that.
Yeah.
But since some people don't know a lot about football.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, so what's the future for Julian Dix then? Are we looking for managers' jobs, or are we...
Yeah, as I said to you earlier, just trying to get a job is difficult. I don't know why I can't get a job. I put my CVs into quite a few clubs. Some of them don't even respond. Some of them probably think it's about money, but I've never done football for money. I've never negotiated contracts. My club went, right, this is what you're having. That's what I was happy with, because I just wanted to play football. And it's the same in management. As long as I'm not out of pocket, so if it costs £100 a week in petrol, then as long as I get me 100 quid, then I'm fine. So, but hopefully there is a job out there for me. But at the moment, I just go around coaching. I've got my own coaching academy. I just go into teams and clubs and schools and put on coaching sessions.
So how's that going?
It's been really, really good. I mean, I get the feedback's been absolutely fantastic. And again, it's only me. I'm a one-man band. I just go anywhere and go and coach.
Because I know one of the local clubs around the area in Langley Colts, you do a bit for one of a couple of Langley Colts teams and
yeah,
stuff in there.
Yeah, like, so I coach from basically under eights upwards. Mm-hmm. Some days you want to pull your hair out, but it is what it is, and I enjoy it. And like I said, as long as people want to learn and they're enthusiastic, then that's it. That's good for me.
It sounds like you've got your life's quite full.
It is.
You just want to get back. You want to get that step. And I would say to people personally, I've met you twice now, and I can. I've always make a laugh and joke, and I was joking with people downstairs. First time I met you, and I remember it really vividly as if it was yesterday. And you just think of again and make. Completely wrongly, the reputation, and all of a sudden, mm-hmm. I think we met in a dark car park at the Link a few years back, and all of a sudden, I heard you call my name, and I'm thinking, it's true, if I'm meeting Julian Dix in a dark car park, what's going on here? Do you know what I mean? And it was one of those things, we sat down, we chatted for, I think you said you was going to come in for about, we had a business proposal, it lasted mm-hmm. 20 minutes, I think you were still there an hour and a half later, just generally talking football, mm-hmm. as we've done today. And if there's people, out there that get to listen to this show, for me, I would say to him, give you a call straight away, because a complete waste of football talent and managerial talent is sitting here in front of me here today in Harlow. And guys, just find Julian's number, give him a call, get him a job, and hopefully by the time this goes out, you'll have a job and
I'm passionate about football, very passionate. I'm very passionate about grassroots football, because I find a lot of the kids don't get coached properly, and that's not the way it should be. We're a great nation, and the kids, they should be able to enjoy their football, and like I said, watching some of the coaches coach them, they don't. So like I said, hopefully, like I said, in the meantime, I'm obviously going around obviously coaching, but like I said, the ultimate goal is basically just to get a manager's job. But I want a manager's job with a chairman that's ambitious. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was offered a job and the chairman said to me, what's your ambitions? I said, well, you're not going to get promoted this year. I said, but next year, I would like to maybe kick on. And I said to him, what's your ambitions? He said, I don't want to get promoted for 2 years. I mean, well, you just wasted all my time because you have no ambition. Mm. So, but I just want a club that want to progress and go forward.
So I want to say one last question. I mean, you've seen Ryman Football Winners with Greys. You may not have seen too much of it recently, but we do this show now, and try and get the likes of yourselves on and Martin and Tony as well on, and it's, I mean, what would you say is the thing to get people out to watch Ryman football? What would you say to them to do?
Well, it's proper football. Mm. There's tackles, which you don't see in the Premiership. There's the physical side of it, which you don't see in the Premiership. There's, like I said, especially in non-league football, if people go down, then they're injured. Mm. I mean, they don't roll about, or obviously you get the one or two, but they don't roll about. And it's good banter. And to be honest, there's some good players out there. Mm. They should be playing a lot higher. Mm. So again, it's a case of even scouts going to watch them. I mean, I've watched, obviously over the years, I've watched many, many games, and I've seen many, many good players just stay at that level. Mm. And they just, a lot of them just need a chance.
Yeah. I mean, I said to you beforehand, I started here at Arlo probably 2 years ago, and just fall in love with it. I mean, mm. I work for a local supermarket. I have to try and get time off on a Saturday to come over here to do it. Sundays when they say, no, you can't do it, it's like the end of the world, because you just want to get over here and do it, because it just feels like a massive family here in this club, and people that you've spoken to on the phone or in the studio, they all say exactly the same. It's like one huge big family at their club and moving it around.
Well, the thing is, you look at like non-league clubs here at Harlow, people, they're volunteers, a lot of them. Mm. They work because they're around the ground, but one, because they enjoy it, and two, they get to see the game being played.
Yeah.
And it is. I mean, obviously, I haven't played it, but when I was at Greys, we played there and stuff like that. And it is. I mean, non-league football, it's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, I go and watch Braintree when I can, because obviously Alan Devonshire's over there and things like that. And it is. It's good, because it is. There is a physical element to non-league football, yeah, which you don't get in the Premiership. Mm.
Julie, it's been an absolute honour to speak to you again today. Thank you for spending some time with me today to do this for me. And Really do appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, Dave.
No problem.
Thanks, Julian. Thank you.